We're talking with mayors from all over Wisconsin as part of a series of conversations here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our next stop is Rhinelander, the seat of Oneida County in the North Woods. Rhinelander's population is just over 8,200 residents. Looking at the new U.S. Census figures, Rhinelander saw modest growth, about 480 people more than the 2010 census. Do you live in Rhinelander or another community in northern Wisconsin? What issues are most pressing? Is it the safety of drinking water and addressing PFAS contamination? What about the viability of downtown businesses and empty storefronts? It's 800-642-1234. Chris Fredrickson has been the mayor of Rhinelander since 2018. Mayor Fredrickson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start with PFAS, which have been found in two of Rhinelander's drinking water wells at last check. What is the city doing to try to remedy this contamination?
The city is taking a unique approach with a no-fault, no-blame, putting our resources towards fixing it as quickly as possible. When about 2 years ago, when this started to come around, I thought, what happens when you have a problem that is larger than the people, larger than the process that it got there, larger than the process that's there currently to fix it? I said, you had to think outside the box. So I reached out to UW-Madison and a researcher by Dr. James Tingem, and with him and a group of very dedicated, wonderful individuals, including UW Extension's Miles Alexander, Brittany Beyer from Grow North, Stacy Johnson, who was with WEDC, and some other care individuals, we started putting together a process of really analysis of how you fix it. How do you educate the people and how do we get there? That's brought us to now where we're looking at pilots and we're waiting for that infrastructure bill so that we can start on fixing it, removing it from the soil and the water.
We talked with Eau Claire's utilities manager recently, how they're dealing with well contamination from PFAS, and they're considering drilling new wells or building a water treatment center. Is that any of that on the table for Rhinelander?
Absolutely. The two wellheads we have are close together, so filtering that water is a possibility. But from some of the things that we've learned in other areas like Woodbury, the plume gets quite large quite quick because it's a ubiquitous chemical. That being the case, drilling new wells might just be somewhat futile to the point that it'll be there sooner or later. It's a chemical that travels. So filtering is key, and especially for some of our smaller cities here in Wisconsin that aren't going to be able to drill and continually drill to find some of these areas.
So when you look at filtering, what are the costs associated with finding a solution to PFAS? And is it affordable for Rhinelander?
Well, once again, when we looked at some of the places in the past, the southern part of Michigan spent $50 billion removing this chemical in GAC systems, which are activated carbon, just to put the chemical in northern Michigan in a hazardous waste dump. So it's not gone. That being the case, you know, people had asked me, well, what's your end game? And I said, the guy that invented the wheel did not have to understand tire tread, air pressure, you know, anything else. He just knew he had to get to market with X amount of bushels of corn or whatever it might have been. That's our job, too, is just start the innovative area where creative thinkers can get together to start to look at how to fix this. Pilot programs, using them, studying them, being very clear as what removes a chemical, how it removes a chemical, and not worrying about the sales, not worrying about the market chip, but actually truly just looking at, okay, we're here to fix this problem.
How often is the city testing water for PFAS? Are you on a schedule?
Yes, we started out monthly on that schedule of testing for it. It went to bi-monthly, and I don't even know if we moved to quarterly, but our numbers have been low enough that it's not an immediate concern. When we first tested, our PFH excess, which isn't even on the PFAS P4, was 590. And I believe Minnesota limits it at 42 or 47.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Chris Fredrickson, who's mayor of Rhinelander. And you can join in. Do you live in Rhinelander or an area town? What questions or comments do you have about how the city is doing? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chris, let's move on to the pandemic. Oneida County has had more than 5,000 cases of COVID, 92 confirmed and probable deaths from the pandemic, according to State Health Department numbers. How has the pandemic changed Rhinelander?
Anything that you have as a root cause and it's caused death, it creates fear and it creates concern. So it creates a large amount of emotion. That being the case, I believe we did a really good job staying safe during the height or the peak periods when those would come and go. We come from a pretty conservative county that likes their freedoms and will fight for their freedoms to get outside. But we also have pretty spacious areas where you can get outside and enjoy the North Woods the way it is without being very congregated. So I think, to tell you the truth, the dedication of the staff, the health department, we've done a good job keeping people relatively safe.
Perhaps the pressing issue here is, has the Hodag received its COVID vaccine?
As Aaron Rodgers would say, he's immunized.
Goodness. So what is the real story of your Hodag, your beloved mysterious horned creature that is all over Rhinelander?
First of all, we're the only one. It's a beautiful thing to have where people identify you. You can travel overseas, and if you have something with a Hodag on it, there'll be someone somewhere that will recognize you for that. So having that kind of recognition, that kind of branding is just a gift in itself. Next, the pride that comes with it when it comes to our community. Some people would be confused. They would ask Rhinelander, is it a tourist town? Is it a retail town? Is it a manufacturing town? I'm going to tell you the one thing you never doubt is it's a Hodag town. The people here are Hodags. They find a lot of pride in it. It comes from a story that was started by Gene Shepherd way back when, and it's continued to this day and been embraced by, I think our Chamber of Commerce just reported that they had the emoji made out of a Hodag. 70.9 million likes or views. So
speaking of the Chamber, how are Rhinelander's businesses doing after almost 2 years of the pandemic? What is it like out there?
One, workforce is probably an issue more than the pandemic itself that way. Everybody paused, and when they paused, it gave people a chance to look at different lifestyles, working less, spending more time with family, so on and so on. So it's decreased our workforce some. That being the case, even restaurants that have wanted to open or open up full time, like every other city, they have trouble staffing those hours. That being the case, just here in the last couple of weeks, a couple of our wonderful downtown restaurants that had closed either during the pandemic or shortly before are reopening. So we're gaining that steam. It was a festive summer that way. The downtown people out on the sidewalks, walking, having libation, just enjoying themselves again. So it was a good feeling.
So what I'm hearing, though, staffing and finding the workers is still a problem in your neck of the woods.
Absolutely. When I came on 4 years ago, I was a write-in, and I wasn't quite sure which direction to aim my pillars of accomplishment, what I want to do, how I was going to get there. And we aimed towards parks as amenities for young people. The COVID or whatever brought people somewhat home because they realized that the people immediately around them are the people they wanted to be around. That being the case, we're in a housing shortage, and I know other places are also, but we had the housing study done, and we absolutely need to start moving on that. We do have one project now that's got concrete. They'll build this winter, start housing people there, but our need was large.
We're going to talk about housing here in a moment with Rhinelander Mayor Chris Fredrickson explaining the issues he takes on in his city. It's part of a series of conversations we're having with mayors from all over Wisconsin. What would you like the city to do about economic development as the region's paper mills continue to go dark? Have you struggled to find adequate housing or work in the Rhinelander area? Do you have broadband? How is the city doing as a retail hub? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mayor Fredrickson here on the Ideas Network. We're in conversation with mayors from all over Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're focusing on Rhinelander with Mayor Chris Fredrickson. A housing needs assessment for his city was launched earlier this year. Results were presented recently. Reporting in the Northwood Star Journal, the study authors provided dozens of recommendations. What should be done about old housing stock in your city? What priority is housing compared to fixing roads and other infrastructure? 800-642-1234. Mayor Chris Fredrickson is with us for about 10 more minutes. So with the housing study, you know, cities around the country and the state are struggling to provide housing, particularly that's affordable to working class families. What is the situation like in Rhinelander?
I'll say we were stuck. When I look at problems, there's like mechanics to the problem. So you look at the parts of the mechanics of the problem that you can move, and it was pulling out some of the cogs in the machine that weren't moving, so you can start moving some of it forward. Rhinelander being an industry town, being, you know, you pointed out the fact that we have a paper mill, also being the medical hub for the Northwoods. We have the three major providers, or now down to two major providers here in the city. We had X amount of housing stock and X amount of land. So what are the ways you can pull those cogs out and start getting it moving? A housing study drives where you can look to do that more efficiently and with better results. Some of ours that we found were, we don't truly understand the cost of what living is until you dive in and do a deep dive into that housing. Truly look at what our residents, our people can afford, and look at what they want. So that was a 91-page study that allowed us to take a good look at it. We'll form a task team, whether it be a redevelopment authority or likewise. We'll use some of the ARPA dollars as far as moving that forward to get it on stable ground. We also recoded and rezoned the city. It was the first time since 1966. So that helps developers come, because they understand that you're up to date with all the rules and laws, and they have a clear picture of what they're looking at. Those are some of the steps we took, and now it's listening to the people and making sure they get what they need and want.
You mentioned American Rescue Plan Act, the relief aid from the federal government. What impact has that had on Rhinelander?
To tell you the truth, we've taken a very patient approach. Rhinelander serves about 25,000 people just with the townships right around it. So even though we have 8,200 people here, we serve a larger population with our infrastructure. That being the case, our county, you know, county government got $6.9 million. We're due two chunks of $400,000, so $800,000. So looking to take those programs and group them together to get more bang for your buck, larger demographics being taken care of or whatever. Even when it comes to housing, new cap, which will take foreclosed properties and turn around and redo them, that's a county program. So making sure that gets off the ground with the city and the county, so that houses just in the area completely get rehabbed and moved along. So our patient approach with ARPA dollars is so we could be the most effective with it. That being the case, we've taken the suggestions from some of our department heads. We'll collaborate those with our council and a wish list, and then also reach out to the people and have an open session again, where they kind of can look at what some of the problems are. As a leader, as a CEO, one of the things I do with the city is alpha deltas. What are our strengths and what are our weaknesses? Anytime you get an injection of cash, one of the things you want to do is promote your strengths so you even get stronger, but then also cover some of those deltas, some of those things that you haven't paid that much attention to in quite a while. So if that's more robust staffing or whatever the case might be, some area where you're not that strong at. So we're still looking at those so that we don't waste this opportunity.
Mira, let me ask you this. You know, with this 91-page housing study, how do you make sure it doesn't get put on a shelf and collect dust?
Absolutely. I'm a big mayor of dialogue and accountability. Some say I'm a little pushy. I grew up as a coach. So even if you do great today, I'm going to want you to do even better tomorrow. So that being the case, you build a staff around you. You hold them accountable. You push for those things that you need and want, realizing there's limitations, and you give grace when they don't meet it. But now the fact that we identified those 12 things, we're going to take them one at a time and make sure they start to happen.
Do you miss coaching?
Oh, I you know what, tell you the truth, I love those little hodags. I'm only here because I'm only here because I want to give them the best place in the world to live someday, and they deserve it.
We're talking with Chris Fredrickson, mayor of Rhinelander. You can join in at any point here about economic development, about Rhinelander's future, about the water quality, 800-642-1234. Ned is joining us from Sparta. Hi, Ned. What's on your mind?
Well, good morning. I wanted to backtrack a little bit on your previous discussion about PFAS. As a former solid waste manager, I'm aware that landfills, with all our stuff in there, produces waste component called leachate, which is a liquid that can move out of the landfill area in older landfills into groundwater supplies. And more currently, most landfills have some kind of a lining, which means that the leachate has to be collected and then typically taken to a wastewater treatment plant for anybody's guess of what they can do about treatment of that, and then released into surface water. So the question is, does anybody know what about the status of leachates or PFAS in landfill leachate as a potential source getting out?
Ned, thank you. Mayor Fredrickson.
Can I take that? Actually, yeah, we understand that leachate is a high possibility. When we first started looking at our problem, the first thing we looked at was our legacy landfill that was in town. We have a paper company in town. We have a wrapper company, Print Pack, that does candy wrappers. So we had those different issues that it could have been. That being the case, our landfill was not lined. It was sand, and it was covered with phytol remediation, so it had a sand covering. But what we did was we ended up pumping it straight out of there and sending it through our wastewater and then spreading it around three counties. Now, we know we have health effects from that. That being the case, we know the leachate's there. In the comprehensive large scheme, there's a short game for PFAS, and then there's a long game for PFAS. In the long game for PFAS, it's learning how to filter it when you pull the leachate out of those landfills, so you can filter it at also your effluent of your wastewater plants, and then also filter it at consumption. PFAS is most dangerous when it's consumed by humans. Obviously, if it gets to our groundwater, 72% of your body is water, and you exchange it every 64 to 68 hours. So keeping it out of your consumption is the key. So the short game is removing it from the consumptional, the wellheads, or whether it be private lands or whatever, to keep that from being there. The long game, obviously, is removing it from where it can travel in the water and in the streams. One of the things I did early on was I started the River City Coalition of Mayors. And it wasn't necessarily to raise a big red flag on this issue, but it was actually to gain steam that our ecosystem of Sparta or wherever is truly connected. And we're at the headwaters of the Wisconsin. So we truly do affect a large group of people. Does that answer your question?
Well, yeah. Why did I get this out on the radar? Because it's all over the place.
Ned, thank you so much. We heard from Sharon in Minocqua, called, couldn't stay with us. Sharon's supportive of the downtown renovations in Rhinelander, thinks they went well. Also wants to highlight Nicolet College and the nonprofit organization, the Art Center.
Oh, absolutely. Art. I just started a competition with Mayor Rosenberg and Mayor Wiesa, an art competition to promote the arts. I paint. Katie paints, and so does Mike. It's on PBS, the auction right now. But we have a wonderful art start. We really do. We're blessed with that.
Really quickly here, we've heard several times on our program that getting broadband access to rural areas like around your area has been really rough recently, especially in the pandemic. What is the situation like for reliable high-speed internet?
The hardest working person I know is Brittany Byer, and she's working on it. So one of the things as a mayor is you build a team of people around you, you inspire them, and then you let them go. You don't micromanage. I don't know exactly where that battle is as far as you know, dollars, what we're getting, but I promise you she's working extremely hard on it. I also promise you people want to be in this area because of our outdoor recreation, so they'll demand it at some point, and it will get here. Is it ever fast enough when it's government? No, never.
Mayor Fredrickson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Fredrickson, Mayor of Rhinelander. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Recent surveys suggest that a majority of parents want to raise their children to be kind. You know, I'm in that camp, but it's tricky to know where to start when it comes to cultivating kindness. The science journalist Melinda Wenner-Moyer has a new book. It's called How to Raise Kids Who Aren't A-Holes, Science-Based Strategies for Better Parenting from Tots to Teens. And she spoke with WPR's J. Carlisle Larson earlier this year.
Your book is titled, and this is somewhat edited for radio, How to Raise Kids Who Aren't A-Holes. Obviously, I'm not going to say the actual word. You know, why did you want to look at this in particular?
So it was about 2.5 years ago, and I was getting increasingly frustrated by what I felt was a lot of bad behavior that I was seeing around me. And, you know, the Me Too movement, the allegations had come to light. There was just, I felt like a lot of people behaving badly. and I'm a parent, and I wrote a science-based parenting column for Slate for a long time. And I started realizing that what I wanted more than anything else really was to make sure that my kids grew up to be good human beings. And that just felt like really pressing all of a sudden. And I talked to other parents and they were saying the same thing. And so that was really the inspiration for the book. I also started looking at research on, you know, what do we know about how different parenting strategies can shape character and values in kids? And I found there was a ton of research actually, and a lot of it was counterintuitive and a lot of it hadn't been translated to a lay audience. So when I realized that too, I said, you know what, I think I want to write a book that I feel like will help other parents, you know, raise a generation of good people. And in doing so, like maybe we can kind of make the world a better place.
Yeah, maybe shift the tides a little. And what's interesting is you just mentioned that you talk to other parents, but outside of just sort of those conversations, we actually do have surveys that find that parents want their kids to be kind. They want them, and in some ways they prize that over other attributes like, you know, work ethic, stuff like that. Can you talk a little bit about that shift? Because it seems like a shift.
Yes, it's really interesting. Over the past few years, there have been a bunch of surveys done, one by the Sesame Workshop, that's the organization behind Sesame Street, asking parents, you know, what is the most important thing for you in terms of, you know, who your kids become and what they do in the world. And parents have started saying, I just really want my kids to be kind and compassionate and generous. And that matters more than anything else. But what's interesting too, is that when the surveys ask, do you think your child is kind and compassionate and generous? The parents often say no. So it's like, there's this disconnect. They want this for their kids, but they're not exactly sure how to go about achieving it and how to help their kids get there. And that was another sign to me when I was looking into writing the book that, like, okay, there's a place for this book. Like there's interest in this and parents really care about it, but nobody really knows how to do it.
We are talking to Melinda Wenner-Moyer. She is a science journalist and is the author behind the book, How to Raise Kids Who Aren't A-Holes, Science-Based Strategies for Better Parenting from Tots to Teens. She's also behind the newsletter, Is My Kid the A-Hole? Now, can we talk a little bit about what is the sort of process happening in the brain when kids are being jerks?
So one thing we have to keep in mind as parents is that kids have very different brains than adults do. And the part of their brain that's responsible for a lot of what we consider to be like, quote unquote, good behavior it requires things like impulse control and rational thinking and planning. That part of the brain that's responsible for those things doesn't fully develop until kids are 25. Sometimes kids act in ways, and it really just reflects the fact that their brains are not fully developed, and they just don't have the skills sometimes that we think we do. So I think sometimes, you know, parents have this expectation for kids. They should know better. They should be able to be polite, you know, this, that, and the other, when actually, if you look at what their capability is and what their brains actually are able to do, they can't do those things. So I think a lot of times kids are kind of supposed to act like a-holes because, because they just don't have the brain power to do anything else. And I think it's important to keep in mind that a lot of the good behavior that we expect from kids is not innate. It's learned, you know, it's like cultural expectations. I remember the first time, this was before the pandemic, when my son, when he was younger, was introduced to somebody who held out a hand to shake his hand. And I hadn't yet taught my son what a handshake was. And he like ran away screaming because he was like, what is this person's hand in my face? And, you know, so there's a lot of things too, that just take time for kids to learn and, you know, and practice. And so I think we also need to keep that in mind. And of course kids have to make mistakes to like learn where our boundaries are and to learn what the rules are. You know, they're just not born knowing so much of this stuff. And the way they learn is by like pushing against the boundaries and pushing our buttons sometimes.
Now, Melinda, we think about some of the ways that like, you know, embodies what we think of as like a jerk or an a-hole in this case. And, you know, one of them is selfishness. And that is something that kids don't always fully understand what being either selfish or selfless is. So if we wanted to raise kids that skewed more on the selfless side, were more generous, what does science tell us?
What I'm going to tell you, I think, is not something that would be obvious to most parents in terms of what's the best thing to do to foster like generosity and selflessness. But talking about feelings with your kids, letting them have their feelings. So, you know, a lot of times when kids have negative feelings, they're angry, they're sad, they're scared, we want to rescue them. We want to tell them, oh, no, it's not a big deal. Don't cry. And we kind of, you know, we sort of belittle their feelings, or we tell them, you know, don't have those feelings. What the research actually suggests is that acknowledging our kids' feelings, validating them, you know, saying, wow, you seem really frustrated right now. And it must be like, because I just told you, you couldn't have dessert and I understand your frustration. That kind of validation and acknowledgement and just having, you know, talking about feelings and your own feelings, their feelings in characters in books, when you're reading books with your kids, that is directly linked with the development of generous and helpful behavior. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is that, you know, if you think about what it takes for someone to be generous to someone else or to help someone else, they really have to be able to kind of perceive what that other person is feeling and kind of figure out, put themselves in the other person's shoes and think, you know, what if I were feeling that way, what would I want? What would be helpful to me? And that's a skill called theory of mind. And it's a skill that takes a while to develop in childhood. But one of the most important foundations of developing that theory of mind skill is being very literate in emotions and being very comfortable with emotions and sort of understanding them.
Now, for parents that might want to foster this, it might be a little easier said than done. I think it can be awkward talking about how we feel. How can parents model that so it's easier to continue having these conversations?
Yes. I think in some ways it just takes practice. Because I certainly, you know, at first I thought, well, I don't want to kind of burden my kids with my own feelings. And I think, you know, you do have to kind of be careful that you're not oversharing or burdening your kids with, you know, all the things going on in your life. But I have, you know, tried more when my kids come home from school. And after we've talked about their day, you know, I'll say like, gosh, you know, I had a really tiring day and it was a little frustrating because this thing happened. And let me tell you a little bit about it, but here's how I dealt with it. And I share a bit more about what I'm experiencing with them. And we have conversations. Sometimes I ask them for their advice, which they actually really like.
That's really
what would
sweet.
You do? Yeah, they love it. They're like, oh, I'm going to tell mom what to do. Another thing actually that the research suggests is very helpful that involves talking about feelings, but also is directly linked with like generous behavior is to, like when you're making a request of your child and you're talking about their behavior, you link it to the effects it has on the other child. So let's say, I think the example I use in my book is like, I don't just say, please pick up your Legos that are all over the floor. I will say, please pick up your Legos because otherwise I'm going to step on one and it's really going to hurt me. And so I kind of go out of my way to explain the why behind, you know, a request, or if I'm, you know, telling my child not to do anything anymore, I will explain the why and always try to make sure if I can, that that why relates to other people's feelings.
And that's author Melinda Wenner-Moyer, a parent of two who explored the research on how to encourage kids to be generous, honest, helpful, and kind. She talked with WPR's Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, we learn how to motivate our kids while still supporting kindness and how to walk that line. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's continue our conversation about raising kids to be kind instead of, you fill in the word. Science journalist Melinda Wenner-Moyer has a new book that looks at the scientific literature with insights on how to help them with kindness and with generosity. She spoke with WPR's Jay Carlisle Larson earlier this year.
So a moment ago, we were talking about how to teach our kids to be more aware, to be more, you know, avoid being selfish. And that makes me think about the desire for kids maybe to be motivated a little bit more. I don't want to say self-centered, but motivation is a very internalized feeling for a lot of people. So how do we raise motivated kids that don't maybe skew into being a little too self-centered?
Yeah. Well, one of the really interesting aspects of motivation, and one of the big things that the research suggests, is that how we praise our kids makes a really big difference with how motivated they become. And I think also the way that we praise can emphasize sort of what they think is really important about themselves. So this comes from the research of Carol Dweck, who is a psychologist at Stanford. And it surrounds this idea called growth mindset, which some of you may have heard of. So one thing parents often do, and this is not the most constructive thing, is to say to our kids, you know, you're so smart, you're so good at math. And you can imagine too, that this kind of can build up a kind of a little bit of arrogance and self-centeredness, like I'm the best person in the world. But these are really well-meaning things. I mean, we want our kids to know that we think that, you know, that they're great and that we have, you know, a lot of pride in them. But when we praise kids this way and we say like, you're smart, you're good at math, it makes them think of these of like knowledge and skills as something that's set in stone. You know, you either have it or you don't. You're born smart or you're born not smart. And there's really nothing you can do about it. And that fixed mindset, as that's called, creating that fixed mindset makes kids think, you know, well, there's not really much I can do about how good I am at math or how good I am at piano or whatever. And they become less motivated and they actually become more concerned about sort of protecting their reputation and not failing than anything else. So they'll be less likely to try really hard math problems. Like if they've been told you're really good at math and then they get a really hard math problem and they can't do it, they start to think, well, maybe mom was wrong. I'm not good at math. Hmm. And that was all a lie. And so they start avoiding challenges because they want to kind of protect their reputation as being good at math or good at whatever. But on the other hand, if we instead praise kids for effort and we tie their effort to outcomes, so we say, you know, oh, you got an A on your math test. And that must be because you worked so hard, or you studied so hard, instead of it must be because you're good at math. Then kids start to see challenges as something that helps them grow and learn. And they think of these skills as malleable. And so they really start to think, you know, the more I try at this, the more I practice, the better I'm going to get, because they realize that outcome is closely tied to the effort they put into it. And then kids become much more motivated. And there've been really fascinating studies done where researchers have given either fixed mindset feedback saying like, oh, you must have done well on this test because you're so smart, or growth mindset feedback saying, oh, you must have done so well on this because you worked hard. And then after doing that, they would offer these kids hard problems to do. And they found that the kids who'd been praised for being smart didn't want to try the hard problems. They had no interest. They were like, I want easy problems. And the kids who'd been praised for their effort were much more interested in doing hard problems. And they also persevered longer. So there's this really interesting research that suggests that that framing can make such a big difference for motivation.
Well, and let's stick with that theme, because it feels like this kind of goes hand in hand, which is confidence and how to have, you know, a child that has healthy self-esteem versus maybe being a little bit narcissistic.
Yes. So confidence is tied to a sense of self-efficacy, like to think, you know, I am a person who's capable and I can do things. And so actually growth mindset is linked to self-esteem as well. When we use growth mindset and we make kids realize that failure isn't a reflection of, you know, them just not being good people, but failure is just, you know, like a little stumbling block on the way to success, then they handle setbacks and challenges and failures much more, and they become much more confident in themselves, and they, you know, they just see things differently. They see the world differently. They see challenges differently, and they feel like, well, I can become anything, because, you know, even if I didn't pass that math test or I didn't do well on that quiz, you know, I'm still learning from that. I'm getting better. And if I keep working on it, you know, I can do whatever I want. And so that growth mindset is very important for the development of self-confidence. The other big part of self-esteem is that kids need to feel that they're unconditionally loved by their parents. And one of the things that was very interesting from the research that I uncovered is that, you know, we often have, this is again, very well-intentioned, we have this fear about our kids succeeding in life. And, you know, it's true that colleges are much harder to get into than they were when I was growing up. And so we often put a lot of pressure on our kids to get good grades, to get, you know, good SAT scores, make the sports teams, you know, get the lead in the play. And we really emphasize these achievements for our kids as being really important. And sometimes when we do that, our kids interpret that as, my love from my parents is contingent on what I do and what I achieve, and it's not unconditional. So I think to the degree that we can, you know, obviously we're not going to tell our kids that they don't have to get good grades or do well in school, but, you know, de-emphasize, like maybe emphasize learning more, and that we really want our kids to learn and have their brains grow, and not focus so much on these specific achievements. And, you know, with like my son plays soccer, and I talk about how I'm so happy that he's learning so much, you know, with every game and he's having fun, but I don't get mad at him for not scoring a goal. Mm-hmm. So to the degree that we can, you know, ease up on that pressure, but also make sure that we communicate regularly that, you know, we love our kids no matter what. And to just say, sometimes you can even just say that like out of the blue sometimes, like, you know what, sweetie, I just want to make sure that you know that I love you so much, and it doesn't matter what you do, I will love you no matter what. So those are some of the key things from the research on, you know, building self-confidence and self-esteem.
We're talking to Melinda Wenner-Moyer right now. She's a science journalist and the author of the book, How to Raise Kids Who Aren't A-Holes, Science-Based Strategies for Better Parenting from Tots to Teens. And let's talk about something that's sometimes really difficult to talk about, which is bullying. And that's something that no parent wants their kid to be a bully, and no parent wants their kid to be bullied. So how can we teach kids that bullying is not the best behavior?
Right. So interestingly, with parents' perceptions of bullying, we often are very, very worried that our kids are going to be bullied, and very not worried that our kids could ever engage in bullying. And the research really supports this. In fact, parents of bullies are often the least likely to think that their kids could possibly engage in bullying behavior. And I think in order to understand that, and also to know, you know, what do we do to prevent bullying, it helps to recognize that I think that parents have this perception of bullying as kind of an all or nothing black and white phenomenon. Like there's a bully and that kid is always a bully. That kid knows exactly what he's doing. He's a nasty kid and he would be terrible at home. So if you have a nice kid, like they could never, ever bully. And people think of bullies in this, they put them in this kind of box. But the truth is, and the research suggests, that bullying is kind of a continuum. And there are a lot of kids who might bully one day a little bit and then get bullied the next day. And they can be perfectly pleasant at home, but, you know, have trouble in social situations and engage in bullying behaviors in school. And also there's really interesting research too, that suggests that some kids who engage in bullying, they actually really don't understand that what they're doing is hurtful. They don't have that ability to put themselves in other people's shoes and to really, you know, consider the other child's perspective. And they might think, oh, I'm being funny. I'm just teasing. And we're all having fun, when the other kid is very hurt by it. And so what all this suggests is that, you know, we as parents should consider that even our perfect little angels like can engage in bullying. And we won't necessarily see evidence of that at home. And we should have conversations about, you know, the fact that sometimes we can have impacts on our friends. You know, we can do things that can hurt our friends even when we don't mean to. And we really need to think about, you know, are we sure that our friend is okay with this? Should we check in with them and make sure that, you know, they're having fun too, actually, and not just assume? And to talk about the different ways that bullying can look like. And so I think just having these conversations, I think a lot of parents assume, well, I don't need to talk to my kid about bullying because they're not a bully. We actually do. We need to talk about it. And we need to talk about how our choices can affect other people in ways that we might not always intend.
We've talked a lot about raising kids with healthy self-esteem. We've talked about bullying, but I'm curious if we can talk a little bit about how parents, families with their kids can establish values, because they will eventually be out in the world as adults. And so how can parents establish and model their personal values from the child being a toddler to, you know, heading off to college?
A lot of establishing values with kids, honestly, is having conversations with them. So, and often it's having conversations about things that you think you shouldn't be having conversations with your kids. There's this idea sometimes that, oh, my kid is too young to learn about, you know, race or skin color or sexism or consent, or, you know, all of these very gnarly, awkward topics where we want to kind of protect our kids' innocence. But every time we have conversations with our kids about these big issues, we are communicating our own values and our own worldview with our kids. And there are ways to have conversations about these very complex topics in age-appropriate ways. I mean, it does depend on the age of your child, but there's this misconception that, you know, we shouldn't be talking to our kids about these things. It's better, you know, just to avoid the topic. And if we avoid the topic, maybe our kids just won't even develop any opinions about them. Like, for instance, with race, we often, white parents, have this idea that if we don't talk about skin color or race, our kids just won't notice skin color and race. But we know from the research that's not true. And we also know from the research that kids notice that there's a racial hierarchy in society, and they notice white people tend to have more power and privilege. So it's really important, actually, for us to explain, well, you know, racism is one of the reasons this hierarchy exists. It's not that white people are just better or smarter. It's that there's racism. So kids are learning, you know, they're like little detectives. They're observing the world. They're making inferences all the time. And some of those inferences are not really accurate. And they're also hearing things from their friends. They're hearing things on TV. And so it's really actually important for us to go out of our way to have those conversations with our kids and make sure our voice is in there as one of the strongest, because again, it's really helpful to share our values and worldview through the conversations we have about these issues. So that's one of the really important things.
Well, Melinda, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.